Hello, and welcome to The Real, the podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I'm your host, Mark Olson. On today's episode, we're talking about the latest in pop culture in Hollywood. So, of course, that means we're talking about Love is Blind, Netflix's new reality dating show that so many people are obsessed with. And we'll have a fun conversation about that coming up a little later. So please stick around. But first, we want to take a very serious look at Harvey Weinstein's rape trial with two of my colleagues who are actually there covering the trial as it was all going on. And what happens from here? Does this verdict mark a milestone for survivors of sexual assault and workplace harassment? And so here with me now to discuss this are James Quealy and Laura Newbery. Thanks to the both of you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
James, maybe you can just sort of set the scene for us a little bit as far as when you're at a really high-profile trial like this Harvey Weinstein trial in New York City, how is it different from just kind of a workaday criminal effort?
There's a lot more people paying attention and a lot more people in the room. Normally, you don't have to line up at 4 a.m. to get a seat in the courtroom, which was a joyous experience Laura and I both went through in the past 6 weeks. Court is usually quiet. Even murder trials in L.A., a lot of times you'll pop by and you're maybe one of 10 people in the room. This was, you know, the universe is watching. Gloria Allred is flying in from L.A. periodically. The DA himself was normally coming in with his security team. You know, that doesn't happen on your average, like I said, even homicide trial here, gang murder, you know, normal function of the courtroom, violent crime does not attract this attention. Weinstein being Weinstein, obviously that game totally changes.
And Laura, this was in fact the first time you were covering a criminal proceeding like this?
That's correct.
And so what were some of your just general impressions of what it was like? I mean, to have a front row seat to an event like this?
Right. So like James said, this is obviously an unusual trial. But I would say that the energy was both very subdued at times and very dramatic at other times, especially during the cross-examination of these women who were testifying against Weinstein. I think there was like an ebb and flow of energy, but just more extreme.
For anyone who's maybe not fully aware, James, can you sort of fill us in on like what exactly the charges were that were brought against Weinstein and what it was he was convicted of?
Sure. So in New York, Weinstein had initially been charged with 6 different counts of sexual assault related to 4 different women. One of those counts was dropped before trial relating to a woman named Lucia Evans. At trial, he was facing 5 counts, 2 of them the most dangerous to him that would have triggered a life sentence upon, or could have rather triggered a life sentence upon sentencing. Under a New York statute that's known as predatory sexual assault, basically you would need to prove that someone has a pattern of committing a certain type of offense, you know, related to the manner in which they committed the alleged crime, the place in which they did it. So he was charged with predatory sexual assault involving a 1993 or 1994 sexual assault of Annabelle Sciorra, who is the actress most of you listeners probably best know from The Sopranos. And then to be convicted of that, the jury had to convict him of that count and assaulting either Mimi Hallay, who's a former production assistant on Project Runway, or Jessica Mann, who was an aspiring actress who was in a very complicated, at times consensual, at times very much not, relationship with Weinstein over a number of years. So those are the top 2 counts. Then there were individual assault counts related to allegations Jessica and Mimi Hallay had made at separate points in time since then. Annabella's charge could not be brought on its own because of how old it was. So that's what has kind of confused things a little bit. Ultimately, he was convicted of individual crimes committed against Mimi Hallay and Jessica Mann, specifically first degree commission of a criminal sexual act, which carries a maximum penalty of up to 25 years in New York, and third degree rape of Jessica Mann. Both counts that were tied to Annabelle Sciorra's allegation he was acquitted of.
What was the response in the room on the day that the verdict came down?
I would have thought there would have been a gasp or something like that, just given the weight, but it was mostly just kind of quiet acknowledgement. The way the New York State Court officers had set up the room, they were blocking Weinstein. You couldn't physically see him, so I don't actually know if he, you know, hung his head or anything when that took place. There was a pretty poignant moment towards the end of that situation where the jury was being discharged and the room hadn't been unlocked yet. And 2 of the court officers go up to basically take Weinstein into custody, you know, given the way the sentencing could work possibly for the remainder of his life. You know, we'd written about during the course of the trial his physical ills and the fact that he was relying on this walker. He'd had this back surgery and he kind of had a stand on his own. They took the walker away and he almost looked confused, kind of lost as they were about to pick him up. One of his attorneys has said he was kind of freaking out a little bit, asking like, I'm innocent. How could this happen? Another one of his attorneys has denied he said any of that. So who knows? But just from a distance, not being able to hear what he said, he definitely looked panicked as if you know, over the course of the trial, he'd been, I mean, you had seen this in the hallway too, I'd imagine, Laura. Like, he was kind of brash. He was making kind of jokes with reporters, kind of smirking. And I think it was like reality setting in that he might never leave the custody of the state of New York ever again. Like, it really kind of hit him all at once. Like, he was basically not being dragged, but like kind of like lifted and almost a little bit carried out of the room by the court officers when it was all said and done.
Laura, for you, as someone who writes a lot about gender issues, what is the significance to you of what he was convicted of? He was, of course, not convicted of all the charges. He was convicted of these two charges. To you, what does that mean moving forward?
Right. So this is a precedent-setting case in a couple of ways. So in the Me Too era so far, there's really been only one other high-profile case that is anything like the Weinstein case, and that was, of course, the Bill Cosby case. In the case of Weinstein, the issue of force was a bit more murky. And also, you know, he had, especially in the case of Jessica Mann, on and off again relations with these women. So what this conviction means is that a jury found these women to be credible. And in one of the charges, force was not taken into consideration. It was just a lack of consent. So what this means is that they took those women seriously, and these cases are hard to win. And usually prosecutors don't want to take them on. Why this one is so significant, or I guess this conviction, is that more prosecutors may be willing to take on these sorts of cases seeing this particular conviction.
And was it an issue at all during the trial to know that this trial and these charges against this man were being seen in this much broader way, that this was in some way the Me Too movement on trial as much as it was Harvey Weinstein on trial? Was that felt in the room or by other reporters? Like, did you feel like the significance of what was occurring in this sort of bigger picture on national and global way was felt?
Right. Well, you know, none of us live in a bubble. I think it would be impossible to not feel the forces of the Me Too movement at play here. The jury was instructed not only by the judge, but by Weinstein's lawyers to sort of ignore the Me Too movement and just sort of let these charges stand on their own and to evaluate them objectively. But the fact of the matter is that these jurors live in a world where Harvey Weinstein has been the topic of conversation for going on 3 years now. So I think that was definitely ever present in the courtroom.
Can you give me some sense of what those days of testimony were like? There was one day in particular when Jessica Mann broke down on the stand and the court had to be adjourned for the day. She couldn't sort of recompose herself. Did those make for very dramatic days in the courtroom?
They did. I was in the room the day that Jessica kind of had to be escorted off the stand. Pretty much, as Laura had mentioned earlier, I think anytime there was cross-examination, things got very tense. It depended which defense attorney you had up there. It was almost always Donna Rotunno, who was his lead defense counsel, or her partner, Damon Sharonis. They were aggressive. You know, they were asking kind of questions very quickly, clearly attempting to rattle the defendants, you know, kind of tactics that you often see in a sexual assault case. You know, the whole mission when there's no corroboration, when there's no physical evidence, is just to undermine the narrative, to get people to crisscross details. Jessica's that day was specifically kind of, I guess, hard to watch for the gallery and obviously very hard for her to deal with because they had been, I think she was on the stand for almost 3 days in a row, right? I mean, she spent an entire day telling her story, and she was the only of the charged crimes in this case, the only person who had not told her story publicly before. So this was really obviously just a big emotional crest for her just on direct examination. And then she had a whole day and a half of this defense attorney trying to pick away at her story and invalidate her claim. And the moment where she broke down was the fact that a question came up about prior sexual abuse she may have suffered as a child. So just think about, you have this, you know, life-altering experience with Harvey Weinstein that has been haunting you for years. You've now talked about for the first time in public for 2 days in a row, and half of that time has been spent under attack, and now someone is opening up this entire other wound. You know, I mean, it was, she had to be helped out of the room, and I think the way I described in one of the articles, you know, she was led into a witness room that, you know, is supposed to be closed off and the sound is supposed to be muffled, and you could still hear her crying from the other room very audibly.
Can you tell me about the days that Annabelle Sciorra testified? I mean, that at least from the outside made for, again, for some of the most sort of dramatic testimony of the trial.
Yeah, Annabella was the first victim, I believe, to take the stand. So that was just poignant because it was really the first time we'd seen Weinstein, you know, have to face off with his accuser, to really have to hear someone make these claims against him in a public setting. Yeah, she, you know, the assault she described, like Laura had mentioned, some of these were issues of consent. Some of these were issues of I guess, the more violent kind of sexual assault that people think of when they think of, just when they hear that word. And what Annabella described was certainly that. So it was very visceral. She got into some details that I think were less known publicly about him harassing her and stalking her in later years. She got very contentious with the defense attorney. So yeah, that was also pretty emotional. I mean, pretty much every victim's testimony was, you know, it was going to be a very visceral, very kind of produce a gut reaction. I'd imagine anybody in the room, even if you couldn't see them or hear them, you know, reacting that way, you can kind of just like read people's faces in the room. Those were not days that people were just kind of like passively taking notes.
And now from here, Weinstein also has charges against him here in Los Angeles. And so what sort of happens moving forward? He's currently in custody in New York, but then we'll have to face these charges here in L.A.?
The next step is his sentencing in New York, which will take place on March 11th. As I had said before, the third-degree sexual assault charge he's facing has got a range of 1 to 4 years. The criminal sexual act charge, which is related to Mimi Hillet's allegation, is a range of 5 to 25. So if he could face as little as 5 years in prison, he could face as many as 29 years in prison in New York, because those have to be served consecutively, not concurrently. The LADA's office charged him the day before jury selection began in New York with a number of sexual assault counts related to two different allegations in 2013, one at a hotel in West L.A., one at a hotel in Beverly Hills. One of those women actually testified in the New York case against him as well. They have said here they will go forward with the case. They have not provided specifics. Only they have like a tentative agreement with Manhattan DA's office that Manhattan obviously gets to finish up sentencing before L.A. makes any moves, but when or if things will proceed here is kind of unclear. His defense has said they plan to appeal in New York, so that could gum up the works. The DA here is also in a very competitive primary right now. I don't know how much election season may mess up scheduling. You know, there's a lot of kind of balls in the air right now, so we don't really know when or even necessarily if he'll see the inside of an LA courtroom now that he's been convicted in New York.
Laura, I mean, given the nature of the events that we're talking about, it's hard to see this as a triumph or a victory. There really are no winners here. But has the result in this trial led you to feel in some way more hopeful moving forward, or that for survivors that there can be more positive outcomes like this?
The advocates for survivors I've spoken with since the verdict came down, they believe that this may motivate more survivors to tell their stories and to come forward, because this may show them that there's a higher likelihood that they'll be taken seriously by law enforcement and potentially prosecutors. This is certainly seen as obviously not a wholesale win because he was acquitted on some charges, but it's a step forward.
James, Harvey Weinstein's walker became such an issue throughout the coverage of the trial. So many media outlets were talking about whether he really needed it or not, if it was just sort of a sympathy play. And you, in fact, after he had been sentenced, you sort of came face to face with the walker yourself?
Yeah, I somehow ended up in the elevator leaving the courthouse that day with the walker. There had been some suggestions that maybe the surgery was conveniently timed. You know, he had initially claimed that he'd been injured in a car accident in Bedford Hills, New York. The local police said there were no injuries from that, so that was a little suspect. In general, the prosecution did have to deal with that whole, you know, we'd written a story about this. They had to keep reminding the jurors that the man they were looking at was not the man accused of committing these crimes, you know, especially back when the time frame when Annabella is describing an assault. This is a 6-foot-plus, 300-pound-plus man who did not need a walker, who could block a doorway, who could envelop a room. Like, they really needed the jury to envision him at, you know, not peak physicality, because I don't think anybody was ever under the illusion Harvey Weinstein was an Olympian or anything like that, but he was a much more physically imposing force than he appeared to be now. So the walker, yeah, it kind of became like a source of almost like laughs and jokes with him, with the report, like he was being playful about it at certain points, but it also definitely factored into at least the prosecution's argument. It was just another obstacle they had to overcome.
Was that something that was difficult throughout the trial, was to reconcile this man that we were being presented with now versus the sort of Harvey Weinstein of legend and mythology, this sort of like great Hollywood figure? How did the prosecution go about presenting who he was?
They played up a little bit his image, his influence, his swagger, for lack of a better term, in part to kind of get around, you know, one of the things we've written about a lot with this case was the issue of kind of like what some doctors call rape myths in this case, the idea that that an accuser would never stay in touch with their abuser again, that they would never have consensual sex with them again, which in this case was part of the stories of some of these women. They, to explain that, in part, the prosecution kept bringing up a lot of these women, you know, were aspiring actresses or worked in the television. You know, Mimi LeRoy was a producer. They all had stakes in Hollywood where Weinstein was effectively a kingmaker, and they had a reason to want to maintain a positive relationship with him, even if he had done these things, these, you know, despicable things that they had alleged. So that his stature in Hollywood was a factor and actually probably used as a negative against him more than anything else.
In addition to the fact that, you know, these women did say they continued to have consensual relations with him, however strained in some cases for both Mimi Hallay and for Jessica Mann, there was also the matter of, like, continued contact. And the emails that were shown to the gallery, where these women said very friendly things to him, complimentary things, sometimes years after this happened, right? So for people who haven't been schooled on some of these rape myths that James was talking about, this may seem suspect, right? But what this verdict says is that the jury understood those myths and understood that they were, in fact, myths. And again, I just think that basically reflects, I think, the education of the Me Too movement. I do think it's a direct reflection of it in many ways.
Well, Laura Newbery, James Queeley, thanks to the both of you for being here today.
Thanks
for having us.
Now, moving on to something a little lighter. We must talk about the new Netflix series that so many people are obsessing over, Love is Blind. If you haven't heard of it, you're in luck, because I'm here today with two of the foremost experts on the show, my colleagues Amy Kaufman and Yvonne Villarreal. Thank you to the two of you for being here.
I heard Yvonne got a PhD in Love is Blind, actually.
Yeah, I didn't know that I was an expert. I feel a lot of pressure.
Well, let's start with Yvonne. Why are so many people obsessed with Love is Blind? What is it about this show and its take on the reality matchmaking experience that you think people are really responding to?
It's just like there's a lot happening in the format. There's so many different phases to it. I mean, Amy could speak to this, Mark. I'm not like a connoisseur of the dating shows per se, but I think it captures so many elements. First, it plays on the skepticism that we all feel like this is so absurd. Who would really do this? But it also plays up the fairy tale that we all sort of have in our mind that maybe this is possible. People can fall in love and have an emotional connection. So I think it sort of plays to both those aspects. At least for me, that's how I viewed it.
Yeah, and I think, like, the reason it's maybe doing well in 2020 is this goes to, like, The Bachelor, too. Like, it's such an extreme concept. And in an era where we are, like, just swiping all the time to find dates, it honestly does not seem that preposterous to go back to sort of an old school, old world, like, matchmaking thing where it's like, you know, we have enough in common or people very close to us see us together. And so let's just give this a shot because maybe that has as good a chance as finding someone on Bumble. You know, it's like, who knows?
And now for people who haven't seen the show yet, Yvonne, can you sort of give a rundown of, like, what is this show? What are these pods?
I describe it as like going to Catholic confessional, also swiping on Tinder at the same time. In the pod phase, it's basically two people going on quote unquote dates where it's basically they're talking to each other without seeing each other. They're talking to this wall that looks like it came out of Frozen. It's this blue, shiny thing. And they're just talking, sitting on couches, bare feet sometimes, which I found a little gross because I'm like, everyone's bare feet on this sofa.
No, but didn't they have their own pods?
Yeah, but I'm like, I don't know. It just feels like weird having like your bare feet on the sofa and then just switching places. I don't know. That's probably something I would have brought up in the pod phase. Like, that is weird to me.
Are you barefoot right now?
Yes. So yeah, I mean, they're sight unseen. They don't see each other until they propose. And then that's where the drama sort of kicks in.
What is the most exciting part of the show? Is that pod phase when they're talking to each other and it's this sort of unseen courtship? Does that have some parallel to like a dating app when you're sort of like texting and communicating with this person that you haven't met before?
Well, watching it, the pod part was actually my least favorite part.
I wanted more of it because I'm like, I don't know how, I don't see the connection per se. Like,
exactly.
I don't see what bonded people.
Because it was only about two episodes. And when I was trying to sell people on the show, I was like, just get past the pods and then it gets really good. But in terms of why psychologically maybe it worked for the people on the show, I think, I always say this too about like, people always say about Catfish, that MTV show. How could Catfish still exist? And I totally understand how catfish can still exist. I am sure some listeners out there have started messaging with someone they've met on an app. And you text for maybe, you know, a couple days, but like say you text for a week, you kind of start building up this fantasy of who they are. Even if you talk on the phone, you're building it up and you're building it up, and it's like 90 Day Fiance mm-hmm. has the same thing. There's just this power of like getting to know someone in that way and imagining that they are the person you've been looking for. And then that's why Love is Blind proves it kind of doesn't mean, I don't think love is blind, because how many times have you been talking to someone and then the second you meet them, there's just that thing and you're like, I just am not vibing with it. The chemistry isn't there. So I think all those kind of shows have a lot in common.
Well, because it still plays up the idea of you're still projecting a persona that you want someone to fall in love with, regardless if there's a wall. It's still sort of like how you are on the first couple of dates. You're your best self and you're trying to portray like, I'm this great person, I'm this catch. And in reality, when things sort of settle down, people start to see the real person. So
that's why I'm a personal fan. I've come to love Love Island kind of the most, which is a UK show. They've tried it out here, and I think it's coming back for a second season, but it's the best in the UK because they live together for like 6 weeks. It's kind of like Big Brother with Bachelor because they have to couple up, and they see a lot more of that like raw. It's not the like projected. And I thought that was the artificial promise of Love is Blind, and some of it was there, but because they met without seeing each other, they were sometimes stuck in those couplings longer than they wanted to be.
Yvonne, you spoke to creators of the show?
Creator, yeah.
And you put, I think, a very interesting point that the idea of Love is Blind implies something about like who that other person, when you finally meet them, may in fact look like. And yet, surprise, surprise, they all are like actor, model hot, basically. And
not as hot as on some other reality shows.
No.
Like they were more normal looking, I think.
Well, talk a little bit about what the response was when you asked that question.
Well, it was basically like, we're not trying to do a gotcha show. We're not trying to pull a rug under somebody.
But what does that mean? A gotcha show?
I know.
Like gotcha, she's like not 5 pounds?
Exactly. So yeah, it's a response that a lot of people didn't sort of buy. Like, come on. In talking to some of the contestants, you know, I was like, how did you even hear about this show? Like, how were you cast? And it seemed like a lot of them were approached on Instagram by, you know, the casting people. So it's just sort of interesting, like, so were they looking for a specific type of person when scrolling through photos? I don't even know what hashtag they must have used to find some of the people, like Atlanta.
Georgia's singles.
Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, I mean, a lot of the response on Twitter when the show was sort of in the pod phase was like, why isn't there sort of diversity in the cast? And, you know, the creator sort of said that there was more than we saw, but like they can only include so much. It's sort of that sort of response.
That's one thing I have found interesting in the response to the show is exactly what you said. The mechanics of the show and the fact that like they started with a lot more people. They started with a pair of hosts. They sort of like forget the hosts. They forget a lot of the people that, and like in some ways you as a viewer are like, what about so-and-so? What about mm-hmm. so-and-so? But at the same time, you don't really care because they've winnowed it down to like the good ones.
Right. In that sense, it did feel very like
produced.
Yeah. And even when we got to the wedding part, I mean, they weren't extravagant weddings. And
the weddings were trash.
They were a little trashy.
They were all in the same place. Well, how would you describe the aesthetic of the venue?
Even the venue,
convention
though,
center?
Even the venue looked better, like, in the shots where they were getting ready versus the actual, like, where the ceremony was happening.
It was
a little sad.
I know, Amy, you mentioned that the pod phase of the show was kind of your least favorite part. So where does it go from there? Like, what happens on the show once they get out of the pods?
So they have this dramatic first meeting where they see each other, and if any viewers were hoping that they would see each other and act horrified, no one did that. Probably because they are all, like, pretty attractive, but also because they knew they were on TV. Mm-hmm. But I kind of was, like, hoping someone would be like, oh, hi. So they meet, and then they fly them to Mexico, where they have this, like, amazing, they all, like, get to be in hotel rooms.
Like
and,
the honeymoon.
Right. And see if they, like, basically most of them hooked up there. And then they move back to their hometown, which was, they all lived in and around Atlanta. And in the same apartment building, set them all up in apartments. And this part was weird to me. Like, I thought they were really going to go back to their lives, but, like, only some of them were working. Some of them, we met their families. Maybe they just didn't show that. But like,
yeah, I know like Cameron said that Lauren met his family. It just didn't make it to air because he thought maybe it wasn't dramatic enough. And yeah, when they were living in those apartments, a lot of them were going back to work. Like Jessica was still flying in and out and doing all the stuff she needed to do for her job. It's just like unclear what we were sort of seeing on camera.
Yeah, so they have like a few weeks of quote unquote normal life, normal-ish life. And then they all were forced to have a wedding, even if they decided they didn't want to get married. And they come out in a wedding dress and a tux and go up to the altar. And then some really bad officiants and pastors would be like, the experiment has ended. Is love really blind? Do you accept? And then this was my favorite part, of course, because exploitative and terrible. They had to decide
right then and there
if they were going to get married or not. And some of them were just so dramatic.
Yvonne, did you like that part too?
Like I said, I would have preferred the pod portion be longer so I could sort of understand what connected these people on such a deep level. Like, I want to understand why Cameron is crying when Lauren says, I love you. Like, I want to grasp it more fully. I kind of wish we got to see them live in, like, their own apartments and, like, integrate back into normal life fully. Because I thought there were some interesting conversations that happened. I had never seen discussion of finances on a dating reality show. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you have. So I found that very interesting, like talking about student debt.
Oh, yeah.
Or credit card debt.
I don't want to work and I want you to.
Yeah. What you're bringing into relationship in terms of that, what that all means. Like, I had never seen that before. I thought that was very interesting. There was also like the discussion of like too much social media use and you're not paying attention to me because you're paying attention to your phone. And so those sort of discussions I found really interesting. And I thought like maybe.
What about the sex life discussion?
I know. Yes.
So good.
Like, I thought if we maybe had them in their own environment more fully, we could have had more insightful conversations like that.
Amy, do you feel like there were some conversations on here that you have not seen before on a dating show?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that they happen. They just are not shown. On Love is Blind, there's a couple where the man was working and the woman basically said her dream was to not work. Like, she's a bartender, but she does not want to have to. And I've seen that on 90 Day Fiancé, actually. Yeah. Like, there's a woman who straight up, like, I want to be a stay-at-home mom. But I think on The Bachelor, especially, like, as it's tried to seem more feminist, like, and they don't want the women to come across that way necessarily. And so they're, like, career women, or they don't want to be, like, relying on The Bachelor for income. So also, the elephant in the room is that neither of them are probably going to have jobs because they just make money from Instagram in the first few years after these shows. And so did the people in Love is Blind stay in their jobs? Like, is Cameron still like an engineer?
Yeah. Like, so far from what I've seen.
Well, I guess because it filmed so long ago, they couldn't have even capitalized.
It filmed in late 2018.
Yvonne, you spoke to two of the couples, I think fan favorites, Cameron and Lauren, and then also Amber and Matt. And so what was it like talking to them about their sort of experiences of the show, both in making it, but also what's happened in just a few weeks since it's premiered?
I mean, everyone sort of said it's been like a wild ride. They've had to live in this bubble of not sharing too much and being sort of cryptic on social media because there has been a lot of like armchair sleuthing with people sort of examining posts to see if people are still together. Like, oh, this looks like his staircase. Are they still together? So it's been an adjustment, like suddenly having everyone sort of concerned about your love life. Something that I was curious about and something, you know, a colleague and I were discussing a lot was, do they talk about politics and religion during that pod phase? And like, how deep do you get? And like, a lot of them said that they did, at least, you know, as much as you do on a regular date, I guess, without like pushing it too much. That's how they sort of decided, like, who am I sort of vibing with on those sort of fundamental levels? Yeah, I mean, they're still together. There was a reunion show.
Can't wait to watch.
Well, this will come out after.
Mm-hmm. I heard that they needed security because Amber wanted to beat up Jessica so bad.
Oh, I don't know about like whether they needed security, but it did get sort of tense. And there's actually like
Tense between the contestants?
Tense between Amber and Jessica, because Jessica was somebody that, you know, she got engaged to somebody named Mark, but it only happened sort of after she didn't get engaged with like her first choice, which was Matt Barnett. She became somewhat of a, like, quote-unquote villain of the season because she kept trying to make overtures at him, I guess.
Because she fed her dog wine.
I know. Well, that is the obvious thing. But, like, in terms of why Amber would be upset with her is because she was still, like, pining for Matt. And so at the reunion, she sort of let it all out. Like, I didn't appreciate what you were doing to sort of interfere with my relationship. But the reunion was interesting because we see a couple that didn't get married actually are still together.
Who? So,
Damien and Giannina. I can never say her name right.
Why can't people just let go of what's bad for them?
And now this show was an unusual release for Netflix. They kind of released it in, like, batches over the course of a few weeks, and then now having the reunion special. Do you think that led to a little bit of the show's success? Or, like, what do you think it means to see even Netflix sort of, like, tweaking their own release strategies with a show like this?
Well, I think they've realized that the binge model doesn't work for everything. And with a show like this, with just, like, somewhat of high concept format, it helps to sort of allow people to catch up and sort of build on that word of mouth. I know when I watched it, it was like back in January, and I was like constantly in our TV channel on Slack, like saying, have you guys watched this? I need to talk to somebody about this.
I should have known, because I literally said to Matt, like, I'm obsessed with this. It's going to be a huge hit. And he was like, Yvonne said the same thing.
Yeah. And I was like, I need you to watch this so we can talk about it. And, like, everyone was sort of, like, you know, coming to it late. And it was so hard because I'm like, there's a lot to talk about. And so I think in the same way, once people were sort of watching the chatter on Twitter, because there was time to catch up before the finale, more people sort of were able to come to it.
And then do you think that Netflix has just recently started to sort of, like, publish on the site? Like, what's number one on the site right now? Do you think that the show has benefited at all from that as well? Because this is, like, one of the first Netflix releases where people say, oh, everybody's watching that. It's this huge hit. And you actually, we're pretty sure that it's actually a huge hit and there actually are a lot of people watching it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because, like, I don't even see the rankings when I log into Netflix. So I don't know where people are catching them. It has been on the top, but obviously we never know really what those numbers mean. But I think what's helped it more than even seeing that is just Twitter. You wanting to be in the know of what's happening. And then you know anecdotally that people are watching, like when even SNL is doing a sketch on you, even though it didn't make it to air. But that is something where it's like, okay, this is something people are talking about.
In the world of reality shows, and especially reality dating shows, are people sort of like, they chewed up Love is Blind, like we've already, like, watched it and we're, like, through the show, and now are people going to be hungry for, like, whatever the next show is, whether it's a new season of Love Island or the next season of The Bachelor or The Bachelorette? What is sort of, like, the churn of the reality dating?
Yeah,
landscape?
No, it 100% will be like that. Obviously, this is my favorite genre of television, dating reality shows. And I had Love Island UK, The Bachelor, and Love is Blind on at the same time, and 90 Day Fiancé. And it was, like, it was a blessing, okay? Like, I was in heaven. I love that there's a churn because now in 2 months, The Bachelorette will be starting. Right. And there's going to be Bachelor Summer Games. Then there's going to be Bachelor in Paradise. There's going to be a summer version of Love Island. I'm sure they've already started production or at least casting for a Love is Blind season two. There's a Bachelor spinoff show coming called Listen to Your Heart about singer-songwriters looking for love that's hosted by Chris Harrison. Like, it never ends. And frankly, thank God for that.
We're here for it.
Yeah.
Amy, also on the sort of like reality dating front, you wrote a very powerful piece this week about the new Bachelorette who was announced this week for the first time as a 38-year-old woman. And can you talk a little bit about what you wrote about that and what that sort of means to you both for the culture of reality dating shows and also just to you personally?
Yeah, so they named the new Bachelorette. Her name is Claire Crawley. She is a well-known veteran of Bachelor Nation. This will be her fifth show that she's been on in the franchise. And when it starts filming, she's actually going to be 39. And just to put that in perspective, the oldest woman they've ever had as the Bachelorette was Rachel Lindsay, who was 32. And usually, like, it's always a joke. Like, this season, there's one 30-year-old, and she got out, like, very early. It's sort of like the token girl in her 30s. There's been some backlash on the show from the audience who, especially because of this, like, Instagram culture and, like, these girls who are, quote, not there for the right reasons, but, you know, like, 23-year-olds who you don't even, as a viewer, you can't buy into the idea that maybe they're ready to settle down.
Well, it sort of plays into what happened, what we saw in Love is Blind with Jessica.
Exactly.
Like, she was so hung up on being 34 and not married and the age difference with the person, Mark, that she ultimately didn't end up with at the end. But he was 24, right?
Yeah.
She was a constant source of agony for her was being 34. It was like this weird...
The age stuff is... And even on Love Island, the winners this season, the woman, the couple, she almost wouldn't date him because he's 20, but she's like 18 months older than him. Uh-huh. Like, the idea of age is so baffling. But anyway, with Claire, to have a woman who's going to be 39 when she's the Bachelorette is... frankly, like a huge deal for the show, even though it might seem kind of trivial because they have upheld like these women who are so young. And the last Bachelorette, Hannah, was very popular, is 24. And she's like beautiful and young. And now they have a woman who's 39. They're saying like she is just as deserving of love. And obviously we live in a world where when you hit 30, if you're not married, like, yes, we've made a lot of progress. And I don't think there's as much public shaming around that. But like there's definitely an insecurity inside of you that you've not hit some sort of like societal goalpost if you're not married and have kids as a single woman, straight woman in your 30s. And that's sort of what I read about in the essay because I'm 34, I'm still a few years younger than Claire, but I definitely am like, oh man, like when is this going to be considered not cute anymore, you know? And honestly, some of the responses to that article from people about Claire were from men saying that kind of stuff, which was upsetting, but I'm hopeful that they will treat her with respect on the season and that we will get some men who are not like 25. Like, mm-hmm. I want like a 40-year-old dude. If I were Claire, I'd be like, not to be ageist, you can have some like 28-year-olds, but like she's 39. You got to get someone in your lane, right?
Did you watch Love is Blind at all?
Mark doesn't do reality, even though...
Mark.
Mark, actually, we're going to turn the tables. Be real. What turns you off about the concept of like a reality dating show?
There's no response that I can give to this that doesn't make me sound
no, a lot
like
of
a really
don't.
Like a feat elitist snob.
But a lot of people are in your shoes, so I think like...
I just don't like the people. They're not people that I would be friends with. They're not people that I care to know. They're people that when I see them in public, I'm like, ugh. And so it's just like, why would I want to like dedicate hours of my life to hanging out with people that I've spent much of my life trying to not spend time with?
Yvonne, what's your reaction to that?
I'm fine, like to each his own, but it's kind of like, I think it'll pleasantly surprise you.
But I'm not saying I want to be BFFs with Giannina, you
know? No. It's just fascinating to watch.
With that, thank you, Yvonne, Amy, for bringing me up to speed on the world of reality dating television.
I know we've really changed your mind, and tonight you will be binging. Yeah.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Paige Heimson, and our audio engineer, Mike Heflin. Subscribe to The Real on Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review. You can also visit us at latimes.com/The Real.